Welcome to How to Save a Planet. I'm Alex Blumberg, and this is the podcast where we talk about what we need to do to address the climate crisis and how to make those things happen.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Buzz around artificial intelligence is seemingly everywhere. Is your portfolio keeping up? Consider the GlobalX Artificial Intelligence and Technology ETF, ticker AIQ, which invests in dozens of stocks at the leading edge of this disruption. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Technology companies can be affected by rapid product obsolescence and intense industry competition. Before investing, carefully consider the fund's objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in the full or summary prospectus at globalxetfs.com. Read carefully. Distributed by SEI Investments Distribution Co.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today on the podcast, we have something a little different. We are going to be playing audio from an event we co-hosted a few weeks ago with the newsroom ProPublica. ProPublica, if you don't know, is a nonprofit investigative news outlet, and they do lots and lots of groundbreaking, amazing work. They've won many, many awards. And this conversation was about the ProPublica team's investigation into industrial air pollution. So about 6 months ago, they published an analysis of data from the EPA, and they created a map of more than 1,000 hotspots of air pollution across the United States. These are places where pollution is so high that it becomes really dangerous to people's health. There's greater risks of developing asthma or heart disease or even cancer. And those risks are so great that these places, these hotspots, have acquired the name sacrifice zones. ProPublica investigated those sacrifice zones, dove into the data all across the country, and we talked to them about what they found. And we're going to be sharing some of that conversation with you on the podcast today.
Welcome to today's session, Sacrifice Zones, Communities and the Path of Industrial Pollution. We'll get started in just a few minutes. We're just waiting for...
The conversation was moderated by How to Save a Planet's very own Kendra Pierre-Lewis. The two panelists were Al Shaw, who was the deputy editor for the project, and Maya Miller, who worked on community engagement for the project. You will also hear from John Beard Jr. a little bit later, who talks about what it's like to actually live in one of these sacrifice zones, in his case, Port Arthur, Texas. And in this conversation, you're going to learn about all the work that went into this project, but you'll also get the tools you need to find out whether you or people you care about live in one of these toxic zones and what you can do about it. So that conversation is coming up after the break. Welcome back. So as we mentioned before, we're going to be playing you some of the conversation that we had with ProPublica a few weeks ago. It's panel discussion moderated by our very own Kendra Pierre-Lewis and features two folks from the investigative team at ProPublica, Al Shaw and Maya Miller. You'll also hear the voice of John Beard Jr., who lives in Port Arthur, Texas, and is directly affected by the industrial pollution areas that the team at ProPublica analyzed. All right, so we're kicking it off with Kendra Pierre-Lewis, starting off with a question for the panel.
One of the things that I wanted to maybe begin with, the basics, which is, what is a sacrifice zone?
So a sacrifice zone, more generally, is a geographic area that has permanently been damaged by environmental harm or has been economically disinvested in over time. And it's usually through locally unwanted land use, and usually is an impact of environmental racism. And it's actually a term that people attribute to the Cold War as first being used around then when they were making nuclear weapon productions, and they were making them in sites that had radioactive fallouts because of those locations.
Yeah, and for this project specifically, we were looking at a specific database that the EPA puts out. And using that database, we identified these sacrifice zones based on areas around industrial facilities that kind of are big enough that they have to report their emissions to the EPA, emit certain cancer-causing chemicals, and individually or in aggregate raise the cancer risk in those areas to above 100,000.
How did that idea come about, and how did you know to tap into that data set?
So the idea started in 2019, actually, and we were working back in 2019 with the Times-Picayune and the Advocate newspaper down in New Orleans. They were working on a project that time looking at the area known as Cancer Alley, which is the stretch, kind of a colloquial term for the stretch between Baton Rouge and New Orleans along the Mississippi River in Louisiana, which is an area that's full of industrial facilities, lots of chemical plants, lots of refineries. It's an area that has long been known as a place that's been overburdened and one of the most burdened places in the country for industrial pollution. And that wasn't news. But what was news was that there were a lot of new facilities that wanted to come into a place that was already overburdened. And so we wanted to try to figure out how are these new facilities going to increase cancer risk in an area that was already one of the most overburdened in the country. And that's when we discovered this database called RESI, the Risk Screening Environmental Indicators database that the EPA puts out, which is kind of an obscure database. But the cool thing about it was it models these emissions and these concentrations of chemicals down to less than a square kilometer. So we could use this database to really pinpoint where pollution was spreading from the individual sources and how it bloomed out from the fence lines. And discovering this database, kind of working with it, allowed us to do an analysis that we hadn't seen done before. And we were able to kind of show specifically how these new facilities that were proposed for the area would increase the burden in places that were already overburdened. So that was the first project that we did back in 2019. And then once we published that story for using data for about 7 parishes in Louisiana, we decided, you know what, let's try to do this for the entire country. And that was...
No big deal.
No big deal. It at the time, I think if I knew what I know now, I don't know if I would have said, yeah, let's go full steam ahead on this, because the data was very, very large. But that was kind of the genesis of it. And we built an interactive map for that project that let people see specifically what it would look like in these communities if, say, you know, this new facility was built.
So you're kind of able to see the overlapping risks, right? It's just that you have a power plant in your community, it's that you have a power plant and a cracker plant, and now they're talking about bringing in, I don't know, a smelter, hypothetically. But so you have this robust data set and you have this map, this interactive website that you created, but how do you go from that to a story?
Well, we didn't go from that to a single story. Really what it was almost a full mine of stories. And once we were able to do the analysis for the entire country, and that took a long time, we kind of opened that cache of data to a bunch of reporters in our newsroom, and everyone kind of bit off a piece of it. So we did stories about West Virginia, we did stories about Laredo, Texas, Pascagoula, Mississippi, the whole supply chain of Cascade dish soap. We did a lot of different kind of aspects of the story because it was such a rich vein of data. So we found a lot of different sides of it that we could pull off.
One of the things that I thought was really incredible about this series is that you didn't just publish the story and tell the communities to kind of figure it out. You reached out to communities. Maya, do you want to talk a little bit about that engagement strategy and sort of what came out of it?
I would love to. We thought about engagement and community engagement pretty early on in the process, actually. So once Al and his colleague, Layla Yunus, who created this news app, made it available to reporters, I dug in and started thinking about, okay, there's people who are living here who might not know about this, maybe people who have been doing a lot of work around this. Yeah, so I reached out to some folks and just said, hey, is this something that you know about? And this was, you know, just when the database was first became available. And some people said, no, I had no idea and I have all these questions. And other people, for example, there was a woman in Wilmington, Delaware, Penny Dryden, who had learned about this, grew up in this area and had applied for a grant for to do local air monitoring. And so she had really become intimate with like the nuances of this and that had learned some of the answers to common questions. And we also got in touch with Lydia Gerard pretty early on. She lives in Louisiana, and she had shared with us that she went to a lot of community meetings and a lot of EPA meetings and, you know, tried to put input in when people were deciding whether or not to allow a facility to be built during the permitting process. And so as the map was being finalized, we worked with residents to also compile these questions and answers that a lot of people had, and a lot of people just from living in these areas were experts in themselves on, you know, do I buy an air filter? What can I do? Do I write to my legislator? What can I do to like protect myself and my family and my neighbors? And so we were getting that ready all for publication. And then we also wanted to ensure that the residents who live in all these hotspots, there were more than 1,000 that we identified. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't want to take for granted that anybody was a all of those people were ProPublica readers and like knew
kind of to go.
Exactly, right? I mean, come on. We turned to this tool that the USPS, the Postal Service has, where you can essentially say, hey, postal worker, please take this postcard and put it into every household or business on your route. And you just give them a postcard and they do so. And so we mapped out the routes that were closest to the top 15 hotspots. And in these postcards, we wrote, you know, you can learn about the possible cancer risk from industrial facilities near you. We also had it in Spanish. And we actually then through that created a really great feedback loop where people were getting back in touch with us and saying, hey, you know, it's not just cancer. It's also property values have been stagnant in this area. And, you know, I'm afraid to leave my house or the smell is unbearable and I get headaches. So things that people living there from and, you know, gleaning expertise from just living in these areas shared with us. And so having that way to meet people where they were was really important for us throughout the whole project.
One of the things that I think often comes up when doing journalism is like the line between journalism and like activism. Journalists will create something and they'll put out in the world and just hope someone who it impacts will consume it. Do you think that journalism has a community engagement role or that it should have a community engagement role?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I'll tell you a story that I love that is like often passed around the engagement journalism world is that a reporter was covering an entire state and drove into this community and realized that there was a bridge that was broken and spent a couple days reporting on it, seeing how to fix the bridge, et cetera, and put out the story, only to learn after the fact that nobody actually had used the bridge for decades. And so I think one of the tenets of just engagement journalism is ensuring that the people who are affected or impacted by what you're reporting on are a part of the journalism process from the beginning through the middle to end and post-publication, and then closing the loop with them. And so I think that a lot of journalism, you know, we've had declining readership and there's been a lot of reports about lack of trust in journalism and approaching journalism in collaboration with residents who are affected by what you're reporting on is one way to potentially start building back that trust and thinking about, okay, I'm creating journalism as a public service for these residents. What will be a public service for them? What information do they need? What information gaps do they have that we can help fill?
I guess this is for both Al and Maya, whoever, you know, celebrity deathmatch who can answer it. But I feel like a lot of the times when I speak to people who aren't environmental journalists about the public and health and equity impacts of environmental racism, it's often unbelievable to them. I remember I was touring a coal ash pond with someone, as one does, and it was unlined and it was like leaking into the local water supply. And they were just like, how is it? Like, they didn't, like, the guy that was taking, you know, local in the community who was taking us around kept like reiterating this, and they kept turning to me and being like, are they saying what I think that they're saying? Because how can this be real? Have you encountered that feeling during this investigation? Like, people sort of are like, how can what you're telling us be true?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people we spoke to who did not even know that They lived near a industrial facility that was putting out, chemicals into the air that increased their cancer risk. They were just shocked to learn that. And they were like, how is it possible that I have not been told? Why isn't it required that when I'm moving to this area, people don't tell me this? And then the way that the EPA frames cancer risk is like one in, you heard Al mention, 1 in 100,000 earlier. Essentially, after a lot of looking at the science of health and also looking at the economics of it, they've decided that anything that puts a community above 1 in 10,000 cancer risk is what they term unacceptable. And so even if that threshold is crossed, and many of those thresholds are crossed across the country and were revealed in the map, the EPA isn't going to necessarily immediately act. It's not like, okay, you've crossed this threshold for cancer risk, excess cancer risk that we say is unacceptable, and now we're going to start investigating this. It's like they can start investigating it. And so a lot of people felt that kind of frustration of like, hey, I'm living in an area where, you know, excess cancer risk is 1 in 400 and nobody's doing anything about it. How is that so? And so talking to folks who had lived in these communities for a while, as we were reporting this initially, showed us that ways that people took steps into their own hands of applying for grants to do air monitoring, of pushing their local health department to do cancer cluster analyses to see if the rates of cancer were actually higher, so that they could potentially get traction to change the situation that they were in.
Maya, I know that at least in one community, Verona, when they found out they were a sacrifice zone, they pushed for a meeting with the EPA, and then they asked that, you know, ProPublica come out because they didn't think they would be taken as seriously without media. And you all did come out. And kind of what was that experience like?
Yeah, it was really interesting. So we got an email kind of a week or so after publishing, just being like, hey, you know, we saw the map. The local TV station, through a partnership we did with them, had done a piece on it too. So that was also kind of the engagement work of ensuring that people saw this. And I got on the phone with somebody and she said, you know, our mayor's wife actually has cancer and we're all really concerned and we're going to have this meeting next week. Please, will you all come out there? Because we are afraid that they're going to try to discredit the work that you all have done. And without representatives there, to back up the work, then we might be kind of back at square one. And so we went and we were in my colleague Lisa Songwen, and she was in a high school gymnasium with the regional EPA office and the Missouri Department of Natural Resources. And they were all speaking about, this facility and the cancer risk that it causes for residents. And it was pretty astounding to see firsthand witness a community trying to navigate this regulatory system and kind of coming up against roadblocks at every turn. In the beginning, they mentioned how the data is self-reported and is not verified. And someone shouted out from the bleachers, like, that's the stupidest thing I've heard in my goddamn life. State officials, people were getting pretty heated. State officials said that they were prevented by Missouri law to actually take any steps beyond what the EPA was doing. And then the EPA said that they had limited authority over the facility. So they had all these, residents who were just like really, really concerned about being exposed to this toxic air that was increasing their cancer risk. And all the agencies that are meant to protect them were kind of giving them this runaround, or like they were saying that they were, with the regulatory systems in place, really unable to do much. And so it was pretty outstanding to see and pretty reflective of what we heard in other places across the country facing similar risks.
Right. That sounds really frustrating. But before we dive into that, we're going to take a quick break. After the break, we'll hear from someone who lives in another one of the places ProPublica identified as a sacrifice zone. His name is John Beard Jr., and I'll be asking him about what it's like to live in a toxic hotspot. Plus, we'll find out what advice he has for other impacted communities.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promote for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Salute big savings this Memorial Day with Blinds.com. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact, and Blinds.com makes it easy. Choose premium blinds, shutters, and outdoor shades just in time for summer fun. Get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost, all backed by Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Memorial Day sale now for up to 50% off, plus premium door busters. Save up to 50% at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Welcome back. Okay, before the break, we were talking with Al Shaw and Meyer Miller from ProPublica about the work they did to identify hotspots of industrial pollution in the U.S. And now we're joined in that conversation by a man who actually lives in one of the places ProPublica called out. His name is John Beard Jr., and we'll pick up our conversation with him now. John, how long have you lived in Port Arthur?
Kendra, I've lived in Port Arthur all of my life, 60 plus years.
Oh, wow.
It's my hometown.
And so for people to understand kind of what ProPublica identified and also kind of the work that you're doing there now, what can you tell us a little bit about like what the community is like for people who maybe haven't been to Port Arthur?
Well, I like to, first of all, give people a little geography lesson that when you look at the weather map or map and you see where Texas and Louisiana and the Gulf Coast meet, that's Port Arthur. We're a small seaport community. Even though we're heavily invested in oil and petrochemicals, Port Arthur was actually founded by a rail magnet, Arthur Stillwell. And then 3 years after that, the Spindletop Gusher blew in north of Port Arthur in the city of Beaumont, and ushered in the petrochemical age, which we all experience today. And the largest refinery in the country is in Port Arthur. Two other refineries that are quite large are located there, Valero, as well as Total, BASF. We also have serial polluters like Oxbow Calcinining, the German Pellets facility, which takes our beautiful East Texas forest and chops those trees down, grinds them into pulp, makes them into small pellets and ships them to Europe and call it renewable energy. But we've got a heavy concentration. If you Google Earth and look at the picture of Port Arthur, you'll see we're surrounded by refineries and tank farms and pipelines. There's no patch of land hardly that's not even affected in some way by the petrochemical industry.
And you yourself at one time worked in the petrochemical industry, right? You worked in a refinery?
Yes, I did. I worked for ExxonMobil Corporation for 38 years. I was had worked in maintenance as well as process, so one of the guys that basically creates the oil and gas you use. But I was also an emergency responder, an industrial firefighter, and dealt in hazmat management also. So that gives me, I think, quite a good background in this and how these things work and operate in terms of the laws and regulations. And also, as I think Maya mentioned earlier, the kind of shell game that these companies play with self-reporting and who's in charge. It's kind of like the Keystone Cops, who's on, or either really Abbott and Costello, who's on first and all of that. It's constantly shifting, and it makes it very difficult for communities and people in general to just navigate these problems and try to get solutions.
And these days, you don't work for the refineries, correct? You work for, you founded the Port Arthur Community Action Network. Can you tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing now and how it relates to the work that you used to do?
Sure. PACON is a environmental and social justice and community development organization.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but we can't let that go by. The acronym is PACON.
Yes. Not that PECAN, it's PACON.
That is delightful.
Or sometimes in the hyphenated form, PA-CAN, which also stands for Port Arthur CAN. And that kind of just came up quite by accident because Port Arthur can be better. It can be different. It can be a good place to live, not just a place to come to work. And that's what's begun to happen, and that'll touch on some of the racial justice aspects of it later. But Pecan was basically started, really, its forerunner was started in 2014 as an outgrowth of the EPA and Justice Department intervening in a case with the Flint Hills Resources Company. And they were accused of emitting into the community, into a predominantly black, historically black community, benzene directly into the air. And they were caught in the lie. I think the plant manager, maybe the environmental manager, did prison time because of that.
What does benzene do? Like, why does it matter that they were emitting benzene into the air?
Benzene is a known carcinogen. And too many times you have these emissions and people will say, oh, it's just a small or minute amount. But here's the question you have to ask them. And this comes from my background in this business. What you have to ask them is, what is the smallest amount that you can be exposed to and not get cancer? Nobody can answer that question. What may be a small amount for me that may do simply nothing may kill you. So you have no way of knowing. So as we try to tell folk all the time, there's no acceptable level of emission. If it is cancerous, if it is immediately dangerous to life and health, then you can't or shouldn't emit it. And if you're emitting it, then you're basically killing people.
And how did you make this big pivot from working in a refinery to sort of pushing higher environmental standards and pushing the refineries to be better and industrial actors to be better neighbors, for lack of a better word?
Well, once again, I was born and raised in that community, and my family, my parents came there, my dad from East Texas, mm-hmm. my mother from Louisiana, in search of a better life, in search of, you know, the higher wages and jobs that the industry at that time created. And I remember hearing my parents and my godparents who lived across the street talk about the fact that you could go to bed that night if your house was white and wake up that next morning and the side of your house would be stained because of something that was released during the night. So we decided to pivot and do this because we saw that there was a need to do things different and better and to change the direction and the way that things were happening in the community, because the quality of life for people was being so adversely affected.
Given all of that and the work that you were doing, when did you first hear about the ProPublica investigation? And sort of how did you react when they showed you the concrete data and how it was affecting Port Arthur?
Well, I was glad someone decided to take it up. It's kind of overdue in a number of ways, simply because in 2010, Port Arthur was selected as an environmental showcase city. And we were told that we have over twice the state and national average for not just cancer, but heart and lung and kidney diseases. And nothing had been done about that since. Nothing had been done. There had been no epidemiological studies. The state had not come in to intervene. The city nor the county had done anything about it. It's kind of, sort of, unfortunately accepted by people. But I have a saying that if you parachuted in or landed in Port Arthur and walked the city streets and went to talk to someone, and you would find not a single person of adult age who would not answer this in the negative. Do they know of anyone who's either had cancer, died from cancer, or is under treatment or in remission from cancer? You would not find a single person of adult age who would tell you no, they know of no one.
That's
in a city of about 55,000 people. That's scary. And I've had numerous friends pass away that worked with me at the plant in recent times, and some of them were people that I've known for a number of years that have died from cancer, you know, mysterious illnesses, rashes, diseases, and nothing's really being done about it. And so that propelled me in my capacity, not only in doing what I did since I retired, but also as an elected official serving on city council for 9 years, city of Port Arthur, and various other capacities, seeing the adverse effect that this industry that says it brings so much good to life was having such a negative and bad effect on the people that lived in Port Arthur.
So, Al, the data is out there. Have you seen it impacting communities already?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of communities around the country have started calling for accountability in meetings with mayors and meetings with local leaderships, regional EPA leaders. It's been happening in, besides Verona, Laredo, a bunch of other places. We've also seen local news stories lead to inspectors going into places that haven't been inspected in years. There was a plant in Michigan, for example, that was inspected for the first time in 17 years. So there's been impact kind of all over the country, inspired by the project and by kind of knock-on effects of local stories about the project. So that's very heartening.
Maya, what would you like to see people do with it moving forward?
Yeah, I guess continue to engage with it. Some experts we spoke to at the outset, both people who live there and people who've been involved in the regulatory process, both on the EPA side and in local health side, said that one of the first steps to achieving impact is for people to understand the risks they face. And so really just hoping that we can continue to get the map out to folks and have them read it, share it with their neighbors. We've heard people doing that and continue to just start conversations around it. One thing I'll add is that during the reporting process, since industrial facilities and many of the ones that we were looking for were responsible for so many products that we use day to day, like Al mentioned, Cascade dish soap was one of the, we tracked the supply chain of Cascade dish soap and seeing all the kind of stops it takes in the local cancer risk it increases for residents across the country. It was hard on an individual level to feel like, we could really do much because I look around my room right now, a lot of the things come from industrial facilities. So while we were working on this thing with Cascade, I tried to avoid the product. And then I was also looking at other dishwasher detergents and saw similar chemicals also labeled on them. So I think, the supply chain is really reliant on these industrial facilities. I think our takeaway has been that, there's ways that there's additional controls that industrial facilities can put on to reduce the amount of these air pollutants that go into the air and increase excess cancer risk. And so I think just trying to do a part of, My part is journalism, and that's just getting reporting accurate information and trying to ensure it reaches people. And so thinking about what your lane is and what your work is and what brings you pleasure and how you can think about taking things that you're good at and maybe creating ways to push the conversation forward in that way.
Are you sure you don't secretly work for How to Save a Planet? Because that sounds like
a very... I listen to you guys. I listen to you guys a lot, so I might have stole that from you.
Because I was like, that sounds like a very How to Save a Planet answer, which is generally individual action has limits. And so what kind of systemic changes can you push for? I'm not going to lie. When I learned that it was Cascade, I felt this like sigh of relief because I don't have a dishwasher, so I couldn't be implicated in this.
It's like the only good thing of not having a dishwasher, I guess.
John, there are other people out there who might be observing similar impacts that you've been seeing, maybe less, maybe not as severe, but similar on their communities, who are in the same place now that you were maybe a decade ago. What can they do? What wisdom can you bestow upon them?
Well, first of all, they have to become educated and informed about the exposures and those sources in their community. And then they have to be willing to engage other people in saying that, hey, this is wrong. We shouldn't be subjected to this. One of the big arguments that I give to people is that being a former plant worker, I knowingly accepted that risk. But I worked in such a way, and the company worked with us in such a way to mitigate a lot of that risk. Yet still people who worked in the plant are dying from cancer and from other illnesses. But the people that live outside the fence line did not sign up for that. They did not sign up to have to breathe polluted, stinky air. And once you come to Port Arthur, and I invite all of you to take a trip down there, we'll take the toxic tour. I'll let you see it for yourself. That they didn't sign up for that, and they shouldn't have to be exposed to it. Or as we said once in my plant when we were about to go on strike, you shouldn't have to die to make a living. Well, you're not even making a living there, but you're still being exposed to something that can kill you. And that simply isn't right. So you have to start to educate your community, to engage other people in asking those questions and holding your elected officials as well as those companies accountable. And then you start working with your county officials, your state officials, and others. Keep working your way up the food chain. Use people like ProPublica and others to get in touch with folk who can make a difference. People have to become concerned and get involved and keep working to find a way to make a difference. Because if you do nothing, that's exactly what you're going to get, nothing.
One other thing I just kind of want to maybe get John to tease out a little bit more is, what is a toxic tour? It sounds
It doesn't sound like the thing that most people generally do on vacation.
No, it's basically a toxic tour takes you by a lot of these facilities I talk about. The toxic tour will get you up close and personal with a lot of what we go through, what we see every day. And you'll even get to talk to some people like Miss Etta Heber. Etta's a cancer survivor who's only recently found she's had another recurrence of cancer.
Oh, no.
Etta's husband, as of December, has only recently come from under hospice after spending the previous year being treated for cancer. That man now weighs, Roy Hebert, less than 100 pounds. Etta's daughter, Angela, is a cancer survivor, and Etta's brother, Eddie Brown, the beloved barber and also founder of the Youth Boxing Academy in Port Arthur, died 2 years ago of cancer. Then you have people like Miss Annette Mitchell, who's a retired school teacher that has COPD so bad that she can't go out in her yard and tend to her flowers as much as she would like to in her garden. And she lives within 1/2 mile of the German Pellets facility. We're surrounded by a lot of degradation, a lot of problems. And I couldn't say exactly if it's racism, but I say this much, that if it were a white community, this would not be happening and much greater attention would be focused on it. But because it's mostly poor black people, there's not a lot said about it.
Yeah.
Sometimes when we do post these things about these incidents, we're told by people, well, if you don't like it, why don't you move? My response to them is, why don't you trade places? Like the movie with Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd, Trading Places. Mm-hmm. Why don't you trade places with us? Let us live where you live and you come here and live for a while and smell this air and hear the noises and hear the shockwaves and the explosions, you know, and stuff like that. And be exposed to the fires.
Thanks. John, one question, and I think this is the last question that we have for you, which is what strategies for holding industry accountable have you found most effective? Or is there anything sort of you kind of just want to kind of get out there for people?
Sure. There's the key thing you have to remember is if you don't engage them and educate people about what's going on and inform them, they don't know. Ignorance can be not necessarily bliss in this case. You have to become educated and self-aware, and then you have to engage other people. And I believe that this is a war that you fight hand-to-hand and heart-to-heart, door-to-door, block-by-block. And you have to have some concern about it because of how directly it affects your life. And then you have to hold these companies accountable to be good neighbors. Matter of fact, EPA is doing something with regard to having a good neighbor policy. So I suggest you check with your regional EPA because there are going to be some workshops with regard to that and taking public comment on what that looks like and how it should be done. And I plan to definitely submit some information to the EPA on that. But I urge people wherever they are to actually get involved and do the hard work. It's not going to be easy. If it was easy, everybody would do it. And as a matter of fact, you wouldn't have the problem. But the only way you're going to change it is to be directly involved and to engage people. It doesn't have to be hundreds of people. It can be just a handful. But if you have the data that ProPublica has, if you have information, if you have very available public data on the health effects, talking to various health agencies and others that work in the cities and in counties, then you have the ammunition you need to go after them and approve it. But nothing is ever going to be accomplished if you sit back and just accept that this is the way it is because this is the way it's always been. Change has to happen. Port Arthur can, you can too. We can make a difference.
All right. That is it for our panel discussion. And of course, it brings us to this week's calls to action. If you want to learn more about ProPublica's series and the sacrifice zones they studied, you can see the entire project on their site. We will include links in our show notes and in our newsletter. If you're interested in finding out whether the place you live in is on ProPublica's map, you can also see that on their site. Search by address, city, or zip code and see the industrial pollution risks in your area. We'll link to that as well in the show notes and newsletter. And we'll also include a link to the EPA database that ProPublica's investigative team used when they made the site. Finally, if you're interested in going beyond just industrial pollution, Al recommends looking at a database called the National Air Toxics Assessment, put out by the EPA. The methodology is a little bit different and the data is not as up-to-date as ProPublica's map, but the data does include information about road emissions and other sources of air pollution. We'll link to that in our show notes and newsletter as well. Our newsletter, by the way, which comes out every week and includes tons and tons of juicy information, fun behind-the-scenes photographs, and, of course, links, you can subscribe by going to howtosaveaplanet.show. This episode was produced by Hannah Chin. Our star moderator is, of course, Kendra Pierre-Lewis. The rest of our reporting and producing team includes Anna Ladd, Rachel Waldholz, Daniel Ackerman, and Meg Driscoll. Our supervising producer is Caitlin Boguki. Our editor is Caitlin Kenny. Our fact checker for this episode is James Gaines. Sound design and mixing by Peter Leonard. Special thanks to Rocio Ortega and the rest of the ProPublica team for partnering with us on this event. And thanks to all of you for listening. We'll see you next week.